This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So as we get underway for G7 preparations, this weekend ministers are meeting their counterparts for some preliminary meetings. Katie, what are the things on the government's agenda ahead of the G7?
So this is a series of meetings with Secretary of State ahead of world leaders meeting next weekend in Cornwall. And I think there's two main stories, the first of which is what Rishi Sunak is trying to do, which is ultimately to looking at potential tech tax agreement. And this is some form of online tax. And there's been a lot in the news about this in the past. One of the problems is if a country were to do this by itself, there's lots of loopholes a global tech company could avoid it. So therefore, it has much more impact if you can have an agreement between the leading economies in the world. And now the finance ministers met yesterday at Lancaster House and there are further discussions today, and I think there's some optimism that they might be able to thrash out an agreement. When it comes to the dynamics in this, I think it's something Rishi Sunak's been pushing very hard for, but the US has been quite resistant to, and I think there's been quite a lot of work going on behind the scenes from the Treasury meeting, I think EU leaders even just before Christmas, to try and set in motion and win support to the proposals. So I think that's one thing to look out for. And we might get some white smoke later today, but it could take a bit longer. But if you can get that over the line, I think that's the Chancellor's number one priority. And then the other thing in terms of what Matt Hancock is going to be looking at is pandemic preparedness. And I think this inevitably is also going to lead to a conversation over, yes, how do you respond to future pandemics, but also let's talk about the one that we're currently still in. And the fact that the UK is obviously speeding ahead of its vaccine programme. Lots of the countries in the G7 are also speeding ahead, America. But yet we have a situation where many countries, particularly poorer countries, do not have access to vaccines. And what's the solution to that? Now, the Americans are pushing for this idea that you will have a situation where you could get rid of the patents so everyone can start making these vaccines. But that meets quite a lot of resistance from various EU leaders who worry that despite their own brief time proposing export bans, it could put off companies in the future to come up with medical solutions if we're ultimately saying if you fix something and it's good enough, we're just going to let everyone do what you just came up with. So I think that's a tension. I think the UK wants to almost be a middle player on this, which is something to look for.
James, how important are these agreements made at G7? Do they have long-lasting impacts?
So to take the two questions separately, so on taxation, the minimum corporate tax, and the global technology tax, you know, if you can get the G7 to agree on that, you've got a better chance of getting the G20 to agree on that and then pushing it all the way through the system. Obviously, for this to work, this kind of global corporate minimum tax, you need all the kind of major players in the world economy signed up to it. I think there is a chance of it working now because the US is offering, for the first time, the US is saying, right, we will help you tax the profits of US technology companies, something that the US has been very hostile to. Even the Biden administration is threatening the UK with tariffs over its version of a technology tax designed to try and capture some of the profit made in the UK by these companies. On vaccines, the G7 has got to set an example. And I mean, this is an interesting debate about how to do this. So, I mean, in some ways, some of the problem will be eased because, as the Biden administration announced yesterday, it's going to plan for sharing vaccines. Now that the US has got sufficient vaccine supply, it's going to lift its export ban. And once you add all that kind of US production capacity into the global supply chain, you can move through things quite quickly. I think for the reasons Katie said, I don't mean this intellectual property waiver is going to work. I think you'll see the UK pushing hard its Oxford model, which essentially is that you agree to license this for production from anybody. I think one of the complications here is this emphasis on mRNA vaccines, which so far appears to be more effective against the various variants. The production capacity for that is more complex than it is to make the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine or the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so there is a kind of question about which vaccine are you going to distribute around the world. That becomes tricky. There's no doubt that the Oxford vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine are easier to manufacture in bulk in these places than it is to manufacture Pfizer or Moderna. And in some ways, that I think in some ways is why the US is slight. I mean, I think there was an element of a distraction technique with the US offer of waiving the intellectual, the patents on these things, the intellectual property waiver, because I can't remember which one, but a senior person in either Pfizer or Moderna essentially said, I'm not worried about this intellectual property waiver. I don't agree with it on principle, but I'm not worried about it because no one can make this stuff. And I think that is tricky. I think I also think this is the other question that we get to, which is how behind the outbreak in India has put the global vaccination program. Because the whole idea was that COVAX was going to be supplied by India when the Quad, the US, Australia, Japan and India tried to work on this idea of kind of countering some of China's vaccine diplomacy.
Yeah.
The idea again was that India was going to be the manufacturing hub. India obviously has imposed an export ban because it is in such a profound crisis. And if you look at what the Indian government's vaccination targets are, that they need to massively up their daily rate by I think about eightfold to hit them. India is normally the kind of pharmacy of the developing world. I don't think you're going to see any vaccine leaving India for quite a long time.
What's interesting is that on Spectator TV a few weeks ago, Professor Jay Bhattacharya, who wrote a piece about the Indian crisis for us, was saying that in India, the vaccine rollout is not age prioritised. So anyone over the age of 18 can go to get your vaccine whenever, which doesn't sound like it's a good way to prevent the next wave.
I think James's point's really interesting too on how useful would patents really be at this point. And I think in medium to long term, you can potentially see have lots of work on supply chains that it could get there. But I think one of the things that sometimes is underappreciated when it comes to the UK's vaccine rollout and how we got a head start was not just that the Vaccine Task Force, Kate Bingham, made the right bets in terms of placing those orders, but that so much work went in, and I'm probably like, in a way, the most work, the most time into securing supply chains, fill and finish spaces, to making sure that you could move things from country to country. And then in terms of the Oxford factory, making sure that you could get the various things you need. And therefore, it's not, even if you are given, I suppose, the instructions or the way to do it, it's quite a long way from being able to turn things around. And I think that can be a bit underappreciated in this debate.
And Katie, as well as the things that we've talked about, can you give us a look ahead to the G7 meeting next weekend? What's going to be on the agenda?
Well, it's Boris Johnson's first in-person meeting with Joe Biden. And I think there'll be several bilaterals. And ultimately, I think when you think about Boris Johnson's plans for the world stage, this is really the first big event that he's able to do in person since winning that majority of 80. And we know that the Prime Minister's been quite frustrated at the fact he's had to do lots of diplomacy by Zoom. Those around him, even those who are fans of him, say that he is not best by Zoom, he's best in person. And therefore, I think there's various things I'll be pushing for, but I think I suppose in terms of the strategic aims, I think in terms of policy areas, vaccines, as we discussed, the economy, and then also I think there'll be a focus on the environment, which is the number one aim if you look at the government's integrated review in terms of an international aim. And then I think for Boris Johnson, again, not to overstress it, but it is about making personal connections in a way that hasn't been possible because of the pandemic for some time. So there's been lots there before Joe Biden was elected about how Biden would be bad for Boris. Now, James very early on said that this wasn't going to be the case for various reasons when it comes to what the UK and the US have in common in terms of diplomatic interests. But people do think there could be a personality issue. So do the two get along? And how does the Northern Ireland issue come into that? We know that when it comes to the protocol, the US side have said that both sides need to work it out, but Joe Biden has seemed to have stronger ties to the Irish government. And therefore, I think the hope on the UK side is they will almost say, well, you know, you two work it out. But I think issues like that could probably throw a spanner in the works in terms of how number 10 wanted to go and what could actually dominate.
James, the other thing on the G7's mind will be China. We talked earlier last year about this idea of a D10, adding more countries to the G7, inviting South Korea, for example. How's that gone? Are they coming?
So they will be there, South Korea, Australia and India. And I think that you will see the UK try and emphasise this. Now, I think one thing that pushback from various countries, including Japan, means the D10 isn't going to replace the G7.
But they'll be at a kiddies table.
No, I mean, there'll be a kind of joint statement about principles of open societies and the like. But I think there were some people who wondered whether the G7 was going to morph into the D10. I don't think that will be the case. I think that, you know, next year there will be a G7 meeting and it will be distinct from any kind of continuation of a D10. The continuing question is, how do you deal with China? And I think there is a little bit more confidence among the G7 nations about how they can do this. I thought that President Xi's speech talking about China needed a new image in the world this week suggests that, you know, that they have realised that the kind of wolf warrior diplomacy hasn't quite had all the effects that they intended. But I think we are at a kind of profound moment. This is really the first time since the fall of the Berlin Wall that the free world has had a proper economic competitor as well as an ideological competitor. And I think one of the big issues here is that Joe Biden wants to say that, you know, the US is back, you know, US leadership has returned. And I mean, the question is, how much are the other countries in the G7 prepared to accept that? I think that you, if you think back to the Munich Security Conference, to pick up on Katie's point earlier, you know, basically Biden turns up and says, the US is back. And Boris says, yes, brilliant news. The UK is ready to basically fall into its role as kind of first spear carrier. We will be there. We welcome your return of your leadership. Meanwhile, Emmanuel Macron is still talking about, you know, strategic autonomy. And Angela Merkel is saying, look, we don't want to divide the world into two camps. I think the European position on China has hardened a little bit in the last few months. And I think it'll be an interesting question in the G7, you know, how hard the communique goes on China, how much it is prepared to make clear that China is a threat.
And Katie, finally, as you're packing to go to sunny Portugal, how do the prospects of a nice summer look for the rest of us come June 21st?
Well, I think we're just seeing again this debate play out where every day is almost one side, I think, dominates the airwaves when it comes to the scientists versus also some scientists saying things look better. But I would say clearly when you're thinking about this debate, it feels more as though the scientists versus the government. But I think that is a little bit too simplistic in the sense that there are some scientists coming out and actually saying things do look fairly good still. But I think today's probably one of the more gloomy days in the sense that it's begun with Neil Ferguson, who is clearly very plugged into what's happening in government, going out on the Today programme to say that things are looking worse in terms of data than they did last week, and openly saying that when it comes to the transmissibility of the Indian variant, he thinks it might be around 60% more transmissible than the Kent variant. And I think that, now he didn't say this was definite, and he said he thought it could be between 30% up to even nearly near 100% more transmissible, so we need more time for the data. But I think that that gives us a glimpse to probably the arguments being made behind the scenes to the government in terms of what Neil Ferguson said, which was the need for caution. Now, again, I think this is going to play out for several more days until we have a proper steer, because the government is, A, going to wait to get very close to the 14th to make a final decision. And I think also next week we should expect to be a little bit clearer, but even then things can change.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And thanks for listening to this episode of Coffeehouse Shots. Do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from, and join us again for our next episode.